When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Ruck, the Times and Sunday Times podcast. Things are reaching some sort of peak in the Six Nations already, a peak of interest and huge standards. And to discuss it all with me today, I've got our two giant columnists, giant in some senses, but not all. Mark Evans, a former boss of Global Sport. Belgian stilt walking is the only sport he's not been the chief executive of. And a big nod in the direction of Premier Rugby there. It's absolutely ridiculous when able people across the sport are not employed in Premiership Rugby when some of the people who are employed in Premiership Rugby are not very good. Also with us is Al Dimmock, the features editor of Rugby World and one of your favourite panellists.
I just want to jump in here, Steve, I just want to jump in here and say I appreciate how much you had Mark wriggling there in his chair. And everyone's had an amazing weekend. I know we're going to jump in and talk about rugby, but I wanted to pose a question to you, Steve, and to you, Mark, because I made the foolhardy decision last night of watching the staying up and watching the Super Bowl, which with a 10-month-old was frankly reckless.
Brave.
And it struck me that everyone was talking about the halftime show, and my mind was cast back to when Mika did the halftime show at the Top 14 final in 2018. Remember that guy? And I just wanted to put to you, Steve, because I'm imagining that you'll hate the idea, is would you like to see a halftime show like the Super Bowl, a Rugby World Cup final or some other major final?
Do you know what? I don't think it's... I think I would. The only trouble is it takes about 3 hours to get the pitch, get them all off the pitch and all back on again. So there's a gigantic interruption in play. And I don't think if you say to rugby players, look, lads, come back in an hour.
It's a half hour end to end, the halftime show.
Okay, but you'd have to re-warm up and everything. So they wouldn't like it. But, you know, if you see had the likes of Boney M, for instance, could come on and do it all. I mean, Bruce Springsteen, even Bruce thinks that his halftime show was one of the greatest experiences of his career. So the Archies, Boney M, someone like that, Bruce Springsteen, I think you'd be good. But it's a little bit rich for the taste of rugby's marketeers, I feel, don't you?
I don't know. We had... in the big game three, we had a halftime with, I've forgotten his name now, but he was great. Sex on fire. He was great. Out of the X Factor. I think about the halftime show is you can put something on, but it's for the TV audience.
Is that such a bad thing?
No, of course, no, it's a great thing. My answer to your question is I will be delighted when the sport gets an event that generates a large enough audience to make it worthwhile for the advertisers to put a halftime show on of quality. What you shouldn't do is be half-assed about it. You either go full on, right, and go for a really big name, or you don't bother.
I just think it's because the potential number of eyeballs that you could get on a Rugby World Cup. I mean, Justin Timberlake once did a gig in the middle of Eurovision because he knew how many eyeballs, his record company knew how many eyeballs were on Eurovision.
I'd love to do a Rugby World Cup final. That would be terrific. You've got about two, you can get about two songs in, and because you haven't got half an hour, you've maybe got 20 minutes tops. Yeah. But, oh God, give it a, you know what I always say this time, give it a go. Come on, let's have a go.
I think you're right, Mark. You've been the leader in all those things in the field, and I just think that we still think that marketing is putting up a poster outside the stadium to say, you know, this Saturday's match.
Well, segueing in beautifully to our first. Did anyone? I mean, I did. Because I'm sad, but the pre-game at Stade de France was terrific, absolutely terrific. Now that. Night games are easier to do, of course. That they are. When you're coming on late, it's easier to do. But, you know, they weren't. They were in the... And I thought they did a terrific job. Really, really, really good.
And there were fireworks on the pitch as well.
Mark, there was a time, quite a long time, when the Six Nations was the poor relation. And actually, we used to love it because of the fans and the, you know, the tension and whatnot. But we never actually thought it was that dramatically brilliant. Are you saying now that these games, the France Ireland, for instance, is as good as any in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah, I would. I think at the moment those two sides up here, it's no coincidence they were the two teams to beat the All Blacks in the autumn. Mm. And I also think that they have got a really good team base, by which I mean Ireland are largely based, not entirely, on Leinster. And Toulouse have a huge influence, particularly at halfback and the front row, on France. But it's the sheer, I suppose I've used the words again, intensity of which both teams play. It's ferocious in terms of the carrying and the tackling and the breakdown. And it was, I just found it a wonderful spectacle to watch. And I know I tipped Ireland for the championship, and that's not looking good now. But I think at Lansdowne Road, Ireland, I think you've got two outstanding teams now. I think they both win at home, and it was in Paris.
Well, it's worth noting, actually, if you take Italy out of the equation, every home team has won so far in these Six Nations. I don't know what that tells you. It might tell you nothing. It's just an interesting thing to note. Just jumping on what Mark said there was a sartorial choice that I think is worth picking up on. Gregory Aldrete seems to have inherited Richie McCaw's invisibility cloak at the breakdown. And I think he deserves credit for that. I think that's a skill to evade notice when you're there and really slow down ball. But I think for a large part of that game, France just had Ireland's number at the physical contest, particularly in the scrum. There was a moment in the first half where the French pack took Ireland for a walk and you thought, geez, this is they're firing today. But you know, credit to Ireland coming back, and it was just great.
I think it's fair enough to say that if you're going to beat what I think is a very, very good Irish team, I think they've got a lot of they can play a lot of different ways, and I think their offensive setup got Andy Farrell rugby league all over it, and it's at a level that not many other teams can match. But if you are going to match them, you take them on up front. You really go for them in the scrummage and in the physical step, because when do Leinster get beat? They get beat, you might remember, well, I'm sure you do, that time Saracens went to Dublin and did a right number on them up front. Mm. That was largely in the scrum. And La Rochelle was it last year or the year before? La Rochelle beat Leinster in a big game with a huge pack, and they just took them up, took them on up front. They got no momentum. I know this is true of all teams, but particularly Ireland. And I thought France for 55 minutes did exactly that, and then all credit to Ireland, they found a way. And I bet France would be quite disappointed, actually, because the two tries Ireland scored very quickly, which turned it into a classic, were a bit soft, I thought. They have good play by Ireland, but having defended so well and with such intensity, I'm sure France will be really disappointed with that. But that, if Ireland have got an Achilles heel, it's, you can, on a certain day, you can get them after them if you've got a really good scrum, and you can make it so physical, the game, other bits of their game just don't quite get going.
So just come on to Alpha scrumming in a second. But Mark, you made a point there. I mean, one of the big fears in Irish rugby has been Johnny Sexton's departure, which is I don't know whether it's imminent, but it's certainly not going to be very long. What you're saying is that Carberry, he could be sort of calming the nerves now, because if he is turning into a good international fly half, then it is a great thing for Ireland's near future.
Yeah, I think Ireland have got a, if you think about it logically, Ireland have got a production line of players going at the moment, and have done for about a decade now, since the Golden Generation. They're churning them out. The law of large numbers suggests that at some point they will churn out another absolute top quality fly half. I think Carty's a really good player too.
Agreed.
From Connacht. And I think Carberry, if he hadn't had so many injuries, and he's had a heap over the years, he's still not an old. He's not old. He would be further on than he is, but he's still going to be very good.
This was his first start in the Six Nations. I know. That's crazy to think that.
Yeah, I know. But
let's just go to the big lads. I mean, there was a little item yesterday on Weenie Antonio, who, to be fair, when he first came into the team, he was a barrage balloon, basically, who sort of floated around at 1 mile an hour. But blimey, somewhere they've got an athlete out of him. And we always knew if he could do something around the field because of what he does in the scrum. So Antonio and Big Cyril Bai up front, that is a heck of a proposition for anybody, isn't it?
Absolutely. I said yesterday of Weenie Antonio, he's about as heavy as uranium and about as nice to run into. He's just, he's enormous.
He was obviously very proud of that line, wasn't he?
Yeah, I was, yeah. I thought he was exceptional. I mean, he played a vital role in that first try. A minute in, France got off to an absolute flyer, and his hefty work up front and then Intermac's pass out of contact to that very... DuPont running a line that we're all pretty much used to now, of watching him run disgustingly good and actually simplistic lines to get onto the ball and make things happen. But up front, Antonio was just great, and Cyril Bai, if I've not mentioned on this podcast before, I think I've said it a lot recently, is the French coaches are absolutely madly in love with him because of the work he can do after the power in the scrum. He's just got this incredible engine. Okay, sure, they went off after 50 minutes, but very much a tactical choice, but the way he ran onto the ball to score his try was just a blur, and he's just one of those modern players where we're going to be talking about it more and more often. The guys up front have got all the skills as well as being just horrible to play against up front, and you know, it was actually a good weekend for the bigger blokes, because Furlong had a nice tip-on pass that created a break in this game. We had Ellis Genge floating a 20-metre pass for a try. Pass. We had Tadhg Byrne in this game lacing through a frankly absurd 50-22 kick to get an Ireland line-out. Fair play to the fellas up front.
And let's not forget that the other thing I thought that won it for France in the end, they've got a front five bench that must be now the envy of the world, with the possible exception of South Africa. But, you know, when you're bringing on like people like Demba Bamba and Tuffa Fanoa, he's 135 kilos. You know,
But they play a lick as well. It's not like they're just plodding around.
No, you've now got Antonio, who can play for 50 minutes when he used to be able to play for 25.
Yeah.
So now, leaving aside the fact I don't think we should have eight substitutes, and I think it's ridiculous that it's a massive advantage to the larger nations. Leave that for another day, right?
You made that point the other day, Mark, and I totally agree with it.
But while the rules
let's talk about that another day, because I can offer a different view.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. It's all about opinion. It's great, isn't it? But leave that for another day. But one of the great advantages of this French team, right, I think, is that they've got depth across the park, not just in the 23, but outside the 23 as well. We've talked about the front five, but Mo Fana played in the centre alongside Fuku this week. Well, they got Donty, and we haven't even mentioned the magical French Fijian who we raved about for years. So they've got everything. A Villiers. I mean, I listened to Sean Edwards in the week, and they said, well, then you scored three tries the week before, so tell us something about them, Sean. And he goes, well, he said, I won't do it. He said, one tough hombre, you know. And you're thinking, well, if Sean Edwards thinks he's a tough kid, because he ain't that big, he's got to be something.
There was a point where it was sevens on sevens crime. There was a point where he manhandled Hugo Keenan into touch, and he thought, okay, this is set a tone. And in fact, if you know, it wasn't like Ireland were completely embarrassed up front.
No,
because
they
came roaring back, and you know they had front five players playing right into to red time, and they were playing, giving and going, and it was a fantastic match to watch that arm wrestle evolve over the match and change. A thing that winds me up is when we talk about, oh, that team's the better team in the scrum, because every scrum is different, and at the end of the game can be very different to the start of the game. However, so if you look at that and you go, fantastic contest, what was the difference? You look at the 80 minutes on the edge from France, and Penno was exceptional, I thought.
Oh, he's... I mean, I declare it into... I remember him running around Bramley Road as a two-year-old with his dad playing fly half for us, and he was a handful then, frankly. You know, he really was. Damien, Damien! But what a player he is. Somebody on Twitter sort of said, you know, pick your wingers from the... Because I thought Darcy Graham had a great game for Scotland, Penno, etc. And I just said Penno and Perm, anyone from the other three, because he is just sensational. If he's not the best wing in the world at the moment, I do mean the world, he's bloody close. I mean, Comp, Chesney, Colby, I suppose, he's really close.
I think we've done justice to a great game there. I mean, Ireland, England, chaps, now becomes huge. Huge for Ireland, because they certainly wouldn't want to lose two, but it's now become a genuine benchmark mark for Eddie Jones, surely. A genuine benchmark, Ireland at home. If they've got any aspirations whatsoever, they've got to win that, surely.
I think the only thing I would say there, Steve, is that, and to be fair, the fixtures favour England this year. It's at Twickenham, and Alan's already raised the point, and I think it's going to continue through the championship. Home advantage, now that the crowds are back, is back, if you like, to what it always was, a significant factor. And Ireland, I think, are a better team than England. You know, if you played on a neutral venue, if they're playing in a World Cup, I'd put my money on Ireland. At Twickenham, I think that's an even ball game.
Let's go on to a game which possibly not technically as good, but certainly vital for both teams. So we'll stop off at Cardiff on the way to Paris. And one figure towered above everyone in Cardiff, I think. That was Dan Bigger. We'll hear from him now.
A week is a long time in sport when you don't get it right. And we didn't get it right against Ireland the week before. We were outplayed in every aspect. So it was a tough week. And I think there was just a sheer amount of relief, really, from myself and a lot of the lads in the team, because we know that just keeps our hopes alive in the tournament as well. Because if we'd lost on Saturday, it would have been a really tough ask to do anything in the tournament.
Guys, technical accomplishment maybe not as high, but incredible battle, incredible atmosphere, which is interesting because they've cut the alcohol content of the beer. But apparently it didn't affect the crowd. They somehow managed to, I think they've had a drink outside as well. But it was a brilliant atmosphere, incredibly close game. It was fast moving. Wales won it, in my opinion, on sheer passion and also on the embarrassment of being so awful the week before. Al, what are your views?
Okay, here we go. First half, I was sort of like, okay, this is finally poised. Second half, I think you're right. I mean, anywhere else on the planet does Dan Bigger manage to hobble his way through the end of that game? I mean, the way he gritted his teeth and got on with it, I mean, you've got to... I don't want to jump too far ahead to God or Goddess of the Week or Devil of the Week, but he's got to be in the running for the way he did that. And it was just, okay, exceptional. We can have questions about whether or not he should have dropped the goal when Wales had... when he instantly went to drop back and drop the goal rather than maybe try to get a try or something, because they knew they would have had the penalty kick anyway. In the end, that was academic, because Wales managed to hold on from there with just real fire guard defence work against the Scots. And my God, did Scotland in that second half play right into Wales' hands. It was such a stark contrast from even the week before, but also the way that they played in November. I mean, we talk about the way that Scotland's backline can play, but the way that the entire team just kept running into brick wall. It was like watching a cartoon when you see characters running into Acme anvils. The way that Scotland just phase after phase after phase just threw themselves into the thresher and realised that they were making no ground whatsoever. It was just completely bereft of direction, and it just felt like one of those where Scotland should have been energised after half-time. Darcy Graham's try, as Mark mentioned was exceptional. Just a hell of a finish. And that is another guy who pound for pound punches well above his weight. It makes no sense. I mean, I will note again, sevens, you know, develop some players. But Scotland's star players just, the brains trust, if you can call it that in Scotland, just didn't have any answers. And there were just errors. I mean, the yellow card for Finn Russell, mindless stuff. This isn't a bad player. This is a guy who's capable of cracking games open and winning them on his own. But that was pretty mindless. There was a charge down on him. There didn't seem a huge amount of direction. Duane van der Merwe, who, you know, try scoring records last year and just is lethal.
Fabulous game against England.
Yeah, great game against England under the high ball. Lethal. His hands completely abandoned him in this one. And it just felt like nothing was going right, whereas the emotional barometer was pointing directly to Wales. And I'll tell you what, the bashful smile on the face of Liam Williams summed up that game. Everything he touched turned to gold in that second half. And he, looking at his face, he didn't mean it, some of it, but no. You got to take the rough with the smooth, and you've got to say fair play. I mean, even that out the back door offload from him in his own 22 with pressure bearing down on him, great stuff. And you know what, didn't have the quality probably, didn't have anywhere near the quality of France, Ireland, but who cares, because it was tight as hell. There was a bonus point for Scotland somehow, and we roll on into the next week, and it's completely changes the narrative, and that's what we want. We want to be talking about games that are so tight, and who the hell knows what the hell is going to happen next with these teams.
Yeah, well, let's be positive about saying, and that was the Scottish perspective. Now, so let's throw from a Welsh perspective. Well, it couldn't have got any worse, could it? And it didn't. It got a lot better. And I would identify four of the front five for Wales were like a different player. Elias, Francis, Beard and Rowland had... It was quite hard to imagine they were the same blokes who went on the park in Dublin, because they scrummed well. Francis has always been a really good scrummager, and he showed that again at the weekend. But they carried. That we had no carry in Dublin at all. We just couldn't get over the gain line. We couldn't win a collision. It was just pitiful. They won a lot of collisions. They didn't do a lot. They didn't try and play much rugby. It was pouring with rain. Scotland's complete ignorance of the conditions, it appeared to me. Not watching it live, to be fair, I was staggered by. But to give Wales credit before having a go at Scotland, which I will, I thought they were in a hole. They were in a big hole. It had been a very, very tough week for them. But there are still many, many things wrong with Welsh rugby that one win will not put right. But it keeps them in the championship. They go to Twickenham now against, and we'll come on to this, I'm sure, not a great England team by any stretch, in a completely different mindset. Scotland, on the other hand, God, I've lost some money on Scotland over the years. I really have. I mean, I
try losing your mind.
I just was watching it and thinking, well, let's be blunt here. Finn Russell had a really poor game. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't do some good things. He's such a talent. He's always going to do some good things. He did some terrible things, real basic stuff. Kick out on the full. I mean, come on. That's unforgivable. He should have been charged down twice.
He was charged down, yeah.
And yes, you're right, he was once. It should happen more than once. He was doing those slidey, sort of low-level things off the wrong foot. It was just really, really poor. Stuart Hogg goes for overcooks of 50-20, hit the ball almost too well. There were just so many errors. And the other thing that I would say, which I think went across the certainly two of the games, certainly in Rome, or, you know, maybe mention that again later, but they lost the penalty count 13-8. And in a tight game, 13-8 nearly always loses you the game. It's getting a bit like rugby league now, where they almost just even up the penalty count because it's so important. If you lose a 13-8 penalty count in a really, really tight game, and then they blew three lineouts in a row, that was unforgivable.
Of those 13, I'm pretty sure 8 were at the breakdown
They nearly always are, aren't they, these days? I mean, that's where you give away penalties around the breakdown. If you lose your discipline and you're not precise, and they got a warning early on, didn't they, after about 25 minutes... that puts you on the back foot, gives the opposition, the opposition pack, or not just the pack, the opposition breakdown for players, then go, right, well, we've got some license here because this lot are on a yellow card. And it was just a really, really, and Scots fans are actually going mad. It's like one step forward, one step back. It's just, it was from a, I'm delighted for Wales because it would have been, God, if Wales had lost that game badly, I think the country would have imploded. But they didn't, and they lived to go on. Scotland, on the other hand, it's looking horribly like another one of those seasons when they don't make the breakthrough that team is probably good enough to make.
I think they were. I felt sorry for Scotland in the sense that they were clearly aspiring to make that breakthrough, and they do always just come up short. And now, if they say that this is going to be the breakthrough season for them, they're going to have to beat France at home and Ireland away, which is somewhat unlikely. One guy, Mark, I never really rated, but I certainly saw the point of him on Sunday, was Thomas Williams at scrum half. I thought he was very clever.
Yes, and, he did. He played well.
He kept the opposition back row interested, and I thought he was good. I agree with you about Francis, because Wales, you take the likes of Antonio Bailly, who are massive men who can move. Wales's record in producing similar players is negligible. It's awful. But Francis has had to hold them together for years. He may not be the great athlete, but he's managed to hold the whole scrum together for a long time. I also think that Adam Beard, God knows what happened to him in Dublin, because I think he's actually not the new Alynwyd Jones, but I think he could be a really, really good player. Again, you just wonder what, as you wondered with the Lions, you just wondered whether what a fit George North could have done for the Welsh team, maybe give them a bit more ambition. The only other thing is, though, Mark and Al, you can only win. Well, I'm not saying they won by sheer passion, but it can only be a factor a limited number of times. You have to have a better team then. So we'll come on to England shortly, but it was a really nice occasion, and possibly, as we said, technically lacking the accomplishment in Paris. Mark, England, Italy. My problem with that is, as soon as they lost to Scotland, you can go to Italy, and whatever you do, there are grounds for saying it is not valid. I mean, whoever is said to have played well, they're playing against a team that's lost 30 odd games on the trot. So, did anything come out of it that was concrete for you?
I just want to say something about Italy. Before I go on to answer that question,
yeah.
People are saying Italy are making no progress. I don't agree. And I know that sounds ludicrous when they lost 33-0. Their scrum was excellent. I mean, it was excellent. It didn't move at all. And that hasn't been the case for quite a while, until very, very late on when the subs came on again. And I keep coming back to the way that the substitution rules are a massive disincentive, not a massive disadvantage for smaller rugby nations, not just in the Six Nations, all over the global game. But their line-out, only lost one line-out all game. Mm. And their ball retention was massively improved. And I don't think this is a coincidence, but I'll come back to Italy maybe. But England, I thought it was really, really patchy. There was some really good stuff in it. You know, Genji's creation of George's try was terrific. I love the way that Marcus Smith manufactured his own first try. There were some good bits in it. There were passages of play. But Italy have improved their defence. They showed that against France. They showed against the All Blacks, actually, when they kept them scoreless for long periods of the game. And England had to work quite hard. And unfortunately, again, like Scotland, made a huge number of errors. They really did make a lot of, I'm not going to say they're unforced mistakes, but they made an awful lot of handling errors. They made quite a few kicking errors. Marcus played well. I mean, his pass for Elliot Daly's try in the left-hand corner was beautiful. But I wouldn't be waxing lyrical about it, if I'm honest. I thought it was, all right, and no more than that. I don't think Harry Randall's box kicking's up to scratch, or however good he is in other bits of the game. And I think that's such an important part of the game these days, like it or not. I don't think England will be we'll be carried away with that too much. Okay. It was all right.
I don't think we're all a little bit underwhelmed here about England, but what about you, Eddie Jones?
Another pleasing improvement, you know. Little by little, we're edging up, and for a young team, it was a good positive performance because, you know, as we know, Italy have troubled New Zealand in the first half and troubled France in the first half, and we didn't have that trouble with them, which was good for us.
So, listening to that clip from Eddie, it's funny hearing him describe this as a young team. There's a phrase that's been pushed out, New England, and to me it just feels like so much fluff, because we've got Marcus Smith in, and we've got Randall starting, and we've got just a slightly different feel to a couple of positions in the back pack. But I mean, I just wonder if Owen Farrell's fit, does he come straight back in? Is Manu Tuilagi eventually going to come straight back in?
Yes.
It's, you know, is Freddie Stewart looking great under the high ball at the back? New England, or is that just a couple of selections that have put a gloss on things? And I'm not sure if this match is one of those where the England coaches sit down and go, right, what did we learn from that match against Italy? I don't think very much, if I'm honest. And the real where to see where they are is how many of those selections are you going to stick with for Wales, and are we going to see that same halfback combination with the same number eight with Marcus Smith? Are we going to see any of that? I don't know. Or is it going to be some selections that actually we've seen quite a few times from England, and is that really new England? I just want to, I'm not trying to be negative, I just want to see this born out on the pitch and see Eddie, what the new direction is.
Eddie sounded to me like a drowning man clutching at straws for a start, and this new and old England, I totally agree with you, Al. But the thing is, that it is so chaotic. I mean, Mark made a very good point about the basis of the French team. The basis of this team seemed to be Bath, who haven't won a game since 1932. And I don't think that anyone knows what the heck they're doing. I really don't. Unless someone... Eddie has gets his rugby brain back on, or at least someone gives him a gentle kick in the backside, I don't think they have got a clue what they're doing.
I wouldn't go that far.
This young side thing, if he's saying, oh, these are young side, well, pick an old side then. Don't blame us for the old side, critics for the young side.
To a degree, he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't.
Yeah,
he doesn't change the team, which everyone was screaming for last year. I mean, not that I think it makes any difference. I think he is one of those coaches who genuinely does... He reads it, of course. We all read it. But I don't think he takes an awful lot of notice of it. I think he trusts what he sees and what he's in his own way. And... I wouldn't be quite as negative. I'd say the jury is out. I don't think it's and we do tend to generalise from the particular. We've had an away game in Scotland in which they didn't play badly. They should have won it, but they didn't play badly. There were bits of the game I thought were quite encouraging. They've beaten Italy as you would expect them to, with too many errors, but also give some credit to a nil. It's very, very, very hard to get nil.
That's a great point.
In international
That's
rugby.
A good point.
I don't get who you're playing. And I know Italy turned down numerous shots at goal. But I think because England are the biggest team with the biggest following, with the biggest, you know, sort of fan base, they are held to higher standards. And I understand that. And that comes with that's the balance to all the resources and all the players you've got to pick from. But I would reserve judgment on this until they've had, in my view, the two big tests, Ireland and France, in games 4 and 5. England have shown under Eddie Jones that when it comes to games where they're playing one of the other top five nations, and I think the top five nations now are as clear as day, that's when they play their best. And if they go and beat Ireland, well, if they go and beat Ireland and France, they've had a hell of a championship. Never mind the loss to Scotland. If they lose to them both, then I might join the chorus that says, "Look, this is worrying."
You say they're held to a higher standard, Matt. By who? Have you read the press this morning? It's like England have beat the All Blacks 46-0.
Well, I can't be held accountable for your colleagues, Jonesy. Come on.
What Eddie doesn't realise when he complains about the press is how soft the reception he gets on social media. Like all these people in their attics doing websites, and why also he has this unbelievable advantage that when England have played bad, Eddie Jones is the first one to come up, and he can give his excuses. So actually, the media leads on Eddie's excuses. Well, his excuses should be the day after.
That's true in every sport.
Should be this day.
That's true in every sport. See, it was when England football beat Albania and when England Test cricket beat Bangladesh, you know, it tends to get a very, very positive run. It's just a cultural thing. And then when we lose, or England lose, you get a hammering. I mean, I would reserve. I know you're not his biggest fan, but I at the moment would just urge a little bit of, well, let's just wait and see a bit.
I'm sorry. I waited to see under Brian Ashton's regime, Andy Robinson's, Martin Johnson's, Rob Andrews. I waited to see under all those regimes, and I'm not waiting anymore. And I'm happy to say, if you want Eddie Jones's quotes as leading the paper after a big match, don't bother reading the Sunday Times.
Well, I would jump in here just to come in between you guys is
that's all right.
Is a few things. Is the way that this championship is shaped out? Okay, the advantage has been with the home team, so with the exception of Italy, obviously, and. You know, there have been pleasingly tight games. So I suppose it's a case of we've got a fallow week now, and then we'll see what Wales and in with their tails up can produce, and hopefully get a chance to rest up and get fit. Some players that were hobbling a bit by the end of their game against Scotland, and see where England really are against Wales. And that, I mean, we know that is going to be vim, vigour, fireworks, everything that you expect from a Six Nations match with two fierce rivals. So from that, at least from that point of view, we should hopefully get the match to match. And then after that, I just wanted to go on for Italy as well. I was interested to hear Mark talk about, you know, the improvements that they made, and I think that's fair. But
if we're gonna
treat Italy with respect as well, you have to point out where things were badly. Mm. And the season that Paolo Garbisi has been having in France for Montpellier, and
it's been terrific. And he was so disappointing.
And the
it?
Class that he has played with, or the promise that he has shown, he's got to be so much better than he was at the weekend.
Yeah.
And Italy as a whole being directed around the park, and you know, tough moments. There was a moment where they got some phenomenal turnovers, and they looked like they were going to get closer, and then they just coughed up the line out in
three
deep,
times
deep in
three
the enemy
times.
Territory, and it was like, this is the differences that we're talking about. So,
the other thing I'd just like to say, and I've made this point earlier when we talked about Scotland and Wales, and I'm going to make it again because I think it's a really interesting change in the whole game sort of globally. Italy, I haven't seen the number, got absolutely taken apart on the penalty count. Penalty after penalty after penalty. So all their great work in the scrum and the line-out got completely obliterated because their discipline in the breakdown simply was not... Just like Scotland's wasn't.
Yep.
Scotland lost the game, in my view, because they lost the penalty count. And I would say Italy went down to a 33-0 defeat when it probably should have been more like 26-10, something of that nature. And if they could just get their discipline up to their set piece, they become, and I think I said this a few weeks ago, their aim this season should be to become a much more difficult team to beat. And they're just not quite there yet. Although I note, and just for all those Italy naysayers out there, right? France joined the four nations in the five in 1910. Right, didn't win a game for 10 years. Now that might have something to do with the First World War, but you see my point.
That little thing.
They didn't win a championship for 44 seasons. Right, 44 years. I mean, I know Evan's talking about the Italian under 20 team that beat England for the first time over the weekend, 6-0. And by the by, I won't mention by name because he's a young lad, but Can we stop captains at that talking to the referee all the way through the bloody game? It was just embarrassing. But this is not a one-off. Italy under 20s, and that is 20. Look at what France have done on the basis of two outstanding under 20s teams. In under 20s, Italy beat Wales in 2018. They lost by 2 points to France in 19. They beat Wales again in 2020. They beat Scotland by 40 points in 21. And this year now they've beaten England for the first time, who they beat at under 18 level in 2021. Now, those aren't one-offs. That is, we let Italy into the Six Nations too late, by about 15 years, when they were really, really good in the 80s. We blocked them. And now, for the first time in a generation, they look like they might be putting a string of age group teams together, because they've made some huge changes to the way their player pathways are. Largely down, I must say, to my friend Conor O'Shea and his team. They've made some huge changes. We should give those need another 4 or 5 years to come through. You need 10 years. It's actually if you want to, and I'll throw this one in. We don't say Wales should stop playing the All Blacks because they haven't beaten them for nearly 70 years.
Well, no, it's not a bad idea though.
Well, just piggybacking on what Mark said there. It's an interesting point, because what the problem has been for Italy is converting those young talents into their pro setups and getting them playing the way that they should be playing, and then integrating them into the full national team.
For quite a long time, they weren't producing anything.
Yes,
like
exactly.
That. But now they are.
But you know, it's a horrible plug. But I've got to file this in here, is just because whilst we're seeing a lot of stuff about the. Oh, Italy, what's the point of them? Is, you know, if you get the opportunity, please listen to our Six Nations special podcast, where we address this very question, and some of our colleagues go into good detail about what the real state of rugby in Italy is like at the moment, and where the opportunity is, who's potentially waiting in the wings, and that kind of thing. So if you get a chance, please listen to our Six Nations special podcast.
Do you feel that they're on the point of becoming an Acme Anvil then?
God, it's hard keeping track of the nonsense that I come up with.
But we all try.
We all try. It's been an emotional podcast, this one. I should probably take a breath.
Guys, the Six Nations are taking a breath and probably needs it, but it's been sensational so far, and I just feel it's infecting people from way outside rugby's normal orbit, which is good. That's it from the Six Nations for the time being. Really enjoyed the two guys' insights into all that. We're going to go on to the Premiership and then end with our God or Goddess of the Week.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly: smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
And back to the Gallagher Premiership, which you should keep an eye on. Crowds still going along, and teams still playing flat out, albeit without their teams, without their best players. Exeter made a comeback win against Gloucester. Exeter have been struggling just a little bit lately. We were overhauled by Wasps, if you remember, the week before, but they managed to beat Gloucester, which is a decent win for them. Sale flying at the moment. Big win at home to Worcester. And Wasps, they played really well with their team ravaged by injury, no one or two are coming back. They're playing equally well. I scored 41 points, and also Saracens put Harlequins away. Quinton now, unfortunately for them, lost a few on the trot with their key players away. So that's the Gallagher Premiership, still rolling along. And it's time now for God or Goddess of the Week. Very difficult this weekend because there were a few stellar performances. We're going to go to Mark first.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to the Championship, which is, I know we don't spend an awful lot of time on that in this show, and quite, and understandably so, but I'm going to Bedford Pirates on Saturday. I'm going to Goldington Road. I haven't been there for many, many years, so I'm really looking forward to that. And Jersey are playing Ealing. So three of the top four are playing each other at the weekend. And the week after that, Ealing are playing Doncaster, which is going to be really interesting. But Bedford, they are my gods of the week. Bedford Blues, because to win not just by a point or two, but to win quite comfortably, and I know Ealing made a few changes and rotated a bit, nevertheless, you know, it was a full-on game, and they haven't had the best of seasons, Bedford, but to turn over the league leaders with a massively bigger budget, far, far many full-time players, I think that we don't get many, if you like, shock upsets in rugby because it's a collision game. It's very, very difficult to do. I think that is an absolutely fantastic performance and deserves due recognition.
So we have the squad of 22 is are our gods. I think it's a brilliant one. So we're going to say the Bedford Blues
starting and bench.
Right, that I couldn't be better. I always love going to Bedford. I think they're a great club. I've had great times there. Mark, this end of the Championship, these without much assistance, these teams appear to have got themselves together in a way. Do you think there's any hope for the Championship now?
Do I think there's any hope unless it's reformed significantly? And I'm not going to bore you with that at this late stage in the programme. No, I don't. Okay. We've got to sort out the second tier. But again, a bit like substitutes, maybe that's a thing for another day.
Okay, well, good luck to the Championship teams on another
indeed,
day.
Indeed.
Al, God of the Week.
So there were lots of names swirling around my head from the weekend that's just been. Mark mentioned Italy under 20s, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for their result. Obviously, I've spoken about Dan Bigger. I thought he was exceptional standing on one leg. We didn't really debate whether he should have done go for the drop goal or not, but it didn't really matter. I thought Liam Williams, everything he touched turned to gold in that second half. And Cyril Bai, by and large, I think he was incredible. You can hear me gushing about him all over. But I actually wanted to pull out a Mark Evans special and look at the Devil of the Week. And it's a good opportunity to draw attention to the Rugby Europe Championship. As people may know, potentially three teams from the Rugby Europe Championship can go into the Rugby World Cup. The top two teams in that competition will go straight through, and the third team will go into a repêchage. Last weekend, Portugal pulled off a draw against Georgia, a match that many people would not have expected that result. Lots were hoping for something special from them. We've ended this weekend with Spain at the top of that table, Romania in second and Georgia in third, and it's because Portugal had their tails up against Romania. They were winning 27-13, and they were playing some really good rugby. Romania brought on their reserve front row, and they started to turn the screw. Portugal haven't really looked the same since they lost a few guys. Mike Tadger's one of those guys who's a lot of top 14 experience, who does well for them up front, hasn't been available, and they just started to fall apart. And then their scrum half Samuel Marquez slapped a ball down, got a yellow card, and from then on the match spiralled. It's a bit harsh to single him out because his pack really struggled and everything came back, but Romania went on to win that one 37-27. So poor Marquez, I'm going to have to put the mockers on him, and his yellow card was the beginning of the end for them, and they ended the match without much to show for it, and now they're really up against it to try and get that repêchage place to try and qualify for the Rugby World Cup. So just thought I'd give a shout out to what's going on in Rugby Europe Championship.
So he's the Devil of the Week.
Yes.
His name again, please, Al?
Samuel Marquez.
Okay, Samuel Marquez, please, someone ring him, tell him he's won an award. He's the Ruck Devil of the Week. And mine's going to be a bit shorter. Dan Bigger, full stop, completely immovable, mentally just inspirational figure, really nice guy, no airs or graces. And my God, Wales would have struggled without him. They really would. And that's it for now, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks, as ever, to Mark and Al for the excellence of their punditry there. There is one thing I'd like to mention before we go, and that's the passing of Jack Jeffrey, the Evesham winger, after an accident on the field when he was in the act of scoring. The tributes paid to him for his talent as a player and his goodness as a man indicate that rugby has lost someone very, very special. And to Evesham and to Jack's family, friends, everyone affected, we'd like to offer our real, most sincere commiserations and hope the happy memories of him somehow tide you all through. That was The Ruck. We'll be back next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.